Alright, so the date is the 29th of July 2015. I am Clara Manassian Cook in Connaught House on the 7th floor with Paul Rock interviewing him as part of the 120th anniversary of LSE. Paul, can you please tell me your full name and your date of birth?
Paul Elliot Rock, and I was born on the 4th of August 1943.
So, Paul, when was the first time that you came to LSE?
I must have come only when I was interviewed to be a student here. I'd heard of it because I was brought up in Hampstead, which is very different from what it is now. And the parents of friends of mine had been part of a generation that were in the LSE in the 1930s. And so it was part, as it were, of the milieu in which I grew up. I felt as if it was familiar to me. But the first time I came was for an interview. I was interviewed for an economics degree. And it transpired during the course of that interview that it really wasn't economics I was interested in, but demography. And they said, in effect, go next door to sociology. And I was accepted for a sociology degree. In the event when I discovered what demography entailed, which was an awful lot of statistics, I chose another subject, which was criminology, taught by a variety of people, including Terence Morris. And it turned out that I became a professional criminologist. So, like so many people, I fell into it through contingency and accident rather than through a kind of long-term dedication and, you know, high ambition and all the rest of it.
What was your first impression of campus when you first arrived?
It was reasonably small. It was fairly dowdy. The refectory, as it was called, was on the third floor and the food was dreadful. I think it was only improved when we had large numbers of foreign students, particularly American students, doing junior year abroad, and they refused to accept the standard of catering, and things started to improve. The library was in the old building, and it was a kind of warren of little staircases and so on. But for me, it was a treasure house. I mean, I used to spend hours just kind of scouring the shelves and seeing all sorts of wonderful books, which I read on top of those which were prescribed reading. I was impressed by the lectures which I attended, often by people who were very distinguished, in a language which was completely new and much more polysyllabic and much more elevated than anything I'd known at school. And it was a delight. I mean, it was, you know, I felt as if I'd been transported into something which was very cerebral. The standard of teaching was varied, but there were people who really did excel. There was a man called Isaac Shapira, for example, who was a South African anthropologist who delighted in using the click language of the Bushmen. And showed off a great deal, and that was funny, had a great sense of humour. There were a man called Ronald Dorr, who was an expert in Japanese society, and was not a paper I sat, but I went simply because he was such a delightful lecturer. So it was very exciting. I think in retrospect, I got more from my fellow students, and it was turned out to be a very interesting generation. I suppose all people say that about, you know, their experience, but it was a very interesting generation of students, many of whom became quite distinguished in their fields. Partly, of course, because when we got our doctorates and were looking for jobs, the universities expanded enormously, and careers were readily available, and promotion was readily available. I don't know if the names will mean anything to people, but Jock Young was became a criminologist of enormous distinction. His final posting was in John Jay College in New York, but he was an intellectual and political revolutionary. There was Stan Cohen, who went to a variety of places, ending up here as the Martin White Professor of Sociology, and was the first director, I think that was the title, of the Human Rights Centre at the school. Francis Haydenzone, who was always very modest and is now a visiting professor here, but was responsible for introducing dimensions of gender into criminology and crime. She wrote one of the first articles. So there was a whole bevy of us, and we met in what was called Florrie's Bar, which I don't know where it is, but it's now in what was in the old building. Served dreadful coffee and tea. And what a very interesting guy who I've lost touch with called Phil Hughes used to call Bertrand Russell cakes, but they were little cakes with a desiccated coconut which had been shredded and looked like Bertrand Russell's hair. And we just talked and talked and talked and talked. And I think we were self-taught as much as anything else. And we were in tune in large measure with ideas that were emanating from the United States. For me, it was symbolic interaction and phenomenology and micro-sociologies of various sorts, workings of the Chicago School, which had developed at the beginning of the 20th century. And I found that exciting. It was a kind of, you know, the anthropology of contemporary city life, strange world. And it was in those conversations rather than in classes or in lectures, I think, that, you know, we took off intellectually.
So what you're saying is that the faculty that taught you were very good at what they were doing, very interesting, it was actually the interaction with the other students at the time that really sparked off the intellectual thought in the course.
I think that became apparent only later. I mean, I had no standards with which to compare my experience. I just thought this was normal university life. You know, going to lectures, writing papers, attending seminars, and at the same time engaged in fairly continuous conversation with peers. But it was those peers, I think, who in retrospect probably did as much or more to kind of bring me along intellectually as anything else. But the school was a very propitious environment. And the other thing that I remember as a great joy was the library. I mean, I just, as I said, I scoured it, picked up volumes, read avidly. I think now there are complaints about the small number of teaching hours that students are exposed to, but for that, for me, was a great advantage because I had all the time in the world to kind of explore things. You know, following my nose, and the library was, you know, so rich. I mean, it's a wonderful collection of books, and I hit upon all sorts of things through serendipity, which influenced what my thought and still continued to influence my thought.
And sorry, where was the library based then?
The library was based in the old building. And it went up several floors. It was small. It was overcrowded. There was an awful lot of books in various repositories. And, you know, books had, as they say, to be fetched. They came up from what was also called the stacks. But there was a lot of stuff on the open shelves. And as I said, I cruised them up and down and just picked things at random. And it was just a joy, really.
When you were studying at Annecy, when you were a student, were you involved in any student activities or student clubs?
The only time I was arrested was outside an Air Force base, American Air Force base, protesting against nuclear weapons. And it was a kind of a political generation with a small p. I mean, it wasn't as radical as it later became. The year after I started teaching here, there were all the events of the anti-Vietnam War protests and the October 68 demonstration in Grosvenor Square and so on. I mean, that was shortly after I graduated. It was a kind of a politically, as it were, self-conscious generation. There was a group of us who, on I think on Wednesday afternoons or Wednesday evenings, tried to display our cleverness by recruiting various speakers from outside whom we thought we would demolish and found we couldn't demolish. So we had people from the Aetherius Society who believe in flying saucers, somebody from what, I can't remember what it was called in those days, the National Front or its predecessor, the British Movement or Fascist Group. And we found it impossible to debate with them because if we say, you know, there was photographic evidence of the Holocaust and they say, all forgeries, what do you do? you know, so you got stymied. That was another occasion. I think most of the things we organised for ourselves, I wasn't really a formal joiner. I did row, which I hated, and I have no sense of yes, indeed, and I have no coordination. And every week there was this agony of going to the LSE boathouse and being bar and being like a, you know, a galley slave, merging with bloody hands and always being out of step with everybody else. I remember the cop saying, bow you're late. I don't know why I went on with it. I mean, it was, you know, part of a long-term campaign to be fit, which never really succeeded.
Where was the LSE boathouse located?
If I say Chiswick, I may be right, I'm not sure.
Sort of out of central.
Oh, no, it was on the Thames, and it, we had its own boathouse and all the rest of it. It was really masochistic. It's horrible. I still have nightmares about it. You know, merging with bloodied hands and aching limbs.
Did you ever attend any of the student union meetings?
Yes, because it all merges into one. I mean, I came back to the LSE in 67, and that's when the politics of the place became very much more heated. I think whilst I was an undergraduate, it was all fairly quiescent and it only took off later on. But I certainly went to the union meetings later on when I was a very junior member of staff, largely as an observer. But they weren't called union meetings often. What were they called? Something like collectives. There was a kind of revolutionary vocabulary that was introduced. General assemblies.
What were they like?
Very noisy, very animated. And we're talking about the late 60s now, not the early 60s. One or two messianic figures. There was a young lecturer called Robin Blackburn who was ultimately dismissed, which is unusual, who actually exhorted students to go to the post office tower where he said there was an armoury to seize weapons and start the revolution. I mean, a lecturer in sociology. It was a time of the LSE was periodically what was called a red base for demonstrations when there were large marches and so on, and the idea was you would tend to the wounded and this would be a sanctuary for, you know, marches. I remember sitting in my office. I'm again advancing into the period when I started teaching, and a number of French revolutionaries came and started using my phone. Daniel Cohn-Bendit and Rudi Dutschke and so on. So there was a sense of, as it were, a great political drama at the time. I was a little distant from it, and it. Sometimes very uncomfortable. I mean, some of the people I've been at school with, I won't mention names, but at secondary school, one was the son of somebody who'd fought and been wounded in the Spanish Civil War, a member of the Communist Party, tried to persuade me to resign and protest some of the school policies. The school was closed for a while and so on. And I felt very uncomfortable. You know, here I was, an aspiring academic, just embarking on a career, and people were trying to kind of make me leave it. So it was a fraught time personally and politically. I never was a revolutionary either. I'm too much of a skeptic, I think, altogether.
And how did you start working at LSE? How did that come about?
I went to Oxford, started on a doctorate. I was at Nuffield College. In 1967, a year before the doctorate, well, whilst I was in my third year of the doctorate, there was a period of massive university expansion, and I applied for, I was coming to the end of my studentship there, it was a paid studentship. I applied for four posts and was offered two of them, and I had 24 hours to make up my mind whether I came to LSE or to go down to Exeter, University of Exeter. I decided on LSE, but it was an extraordinarily buoyant time. There were three people being shortlisted for a post in sociology, and I looked at my rivals. We were all waiting outside the interviewing room, maybe outside this very room, and all three of us got jobs. So that, you know, it was really quite unusual. I was attached to London. I had an affection for the LSE. And I could think of no... And sociology wasn't taught in a great many places at that time. I mean, the number of, you know, possibilities was very restricted. So I returned in 67 as an assist, what was called an assistant lecturer. And by and large, I remained ever since until I retired in 2008.
Was it a bit of an adjustment from being a student at LSE to being a lecturer? Did you find it was quite a different experience?
Well, you may imagine that it's difficult because I was returning to a department where I'd been a student, where a lot of the people who taught me were now, as it were, nominally colleagues. But I think regarded me as being in a very subordinate position. What was peculiar about the Department of Sociology then, and it may have been true of other departments, but I didn't really know what was going on elsewhere, was that it was operated on very clientelistic lines. Professors were very grand. They were very territorial. They had little, as it were, claques of followers, then they expected loyalty from those whom they believed were beholden to them. And they rowed. I mean, it was, you know, I wasn't aware of all the substance of the quarrels, but these were, you know, grandees who were endlessly sparring with one another and, you know, demanded fealty from those who were beneath them. It was really very unattractive, and I would like to think that that doesn't go on anymore.